This is Wendy's Coffee House. I've talked with Carol before. My guest, Carol Matthews, author of Mysterious Beauty, Living with the Paranormal in the Hudson Valley. This is a two-part interview. The story in the second part talks about her encounter with a spider. And it's one of those shamanic type encounters that's extraordinary. So it has its own segment. Again, my guest, C.S. Matthews, Dr. C.S. Matthews, also known as Dr. Wham. Mysterious Beauty, Living with the Paranormal in the Hudson Valley.
One of the things I talk about in the book is I talk about, and I mentioned this in several different places, the persistence of spirit lights, of different types of spirit lights. In fact, there were some that were just seen last week, not too far from me. I have a Facebook page, and a couple people were uploading stuff and of pictures of these lights that they had seen. They're sometimes referred to as fireballs. And what that means is that they're kind of an orange, yellowish light, and there can be two of them, but there can be also many of them. And they often appear over water, like over lakes or pools or over the Hudson River.
Talking with Dr. C.S. Matthews, Carol Matthews, or Dr. Wham, find the book, Mysterious Beauty. You're in an area of the country where it's like Skinwalker Ranch, or people might be familiar with the Bradshaw Ranch in Arizona, some of these highly active places. And you're right in the center of an area that has a tremendous paranormal history there in the Hudson Valley. So, hey, good to talk with you again.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
What I'd like to start with is some of the indigenous stories that you include in your book, Mysterious Beauty.
The reason I talk about them is because the indigenous people that still live here in the Hudson Valley, there is this misconception that all the indigenous people left at a certain point. And a lot of them did leave. A lot of them were driven out. But a lot of them went underground, or as one of my indigenous teachers put it, they figured out ways of hiding in plain sight. And one of the ways in which they did that was to adopt Dutch-sounding names. I mean, if you carefully look at them and do the history of them, they're not really Dutch. They're just Dutch-sounding or German-sounding names or English-sounding names. And they took up certain trades so that, for example, among the Mohawk, there are several clans of Mohawk that are known specifically for steel building. And for working in stone, and in fact, there was a team of them that worked on both the Empire State Building and on the original trade towers. And then there's a whole bunch of Mohican families up north, just north of me, that specialize in automobile repair, and that's how they pass. So, but they maintain a lot of their traditions. And they just sort of do it secretly. And so part of the reason I wanted to have these stories in the book is as an indicator that there are various of these traditions that for white people or Westerners, colonial settlers, we would think of now as paranormal. But from the indigenous perspective, these are not paranormal experiences. It doesn't mean that they're not unusual sometimes to them, but some of the beings they talk about or some of the experiences they talk about most frequently are not considered to be, abnormal. When we say paranormal, that sort of implies that that these things are acting outside of a normal sphere. For indigenous people, if it occurs in nature, then it's not unnatural. It's just a matter of whether or not we're accustomed to it or not, or what it might mean, what our relationship with it is going to be. So, for example, one of the things I talk about in the book is I talk about, and I mentioned this in several different places, the persistence of spirit lights, of different types of spirit lights. In fact, there were some that were just seen last week, not too far from me. I have a Facebook page, and a couple people were uploading stuff and pictures of these lights that they had seen. They're sometimes referred to as fireballs, And what that means is that they're kind of an orange, yellowish light. And there can be two of them, but there can be also many of them. And they often appear over water, like over lakes or pools or over the Hudson River. I actually myself have seen a couple of these over the Hudson River several years ago. But they're not drones. They don't make any noise. They're silent. Sometimes they move in a coordinated way. And sometimes they seem to, I don't know how else to put this, sort of play. They just sort of, they look like balls of light. And they're kind of sparkly, iridescent. They can be various sizes. And they just sort of flit around. And they're also quite common coming off of Overlook Mountain. I talk about this, Overlook Mountain, which is the mountain that is sort of, it's the backdrop to Woodstock, the town of Woodstock. If you drive up, if you drive from the south to Woodstock, to the north, and enter Woodstock that way, it'll look like there's this big mountain behind Woodstock. It's very frequent that people talk about these lights kind of lifting up out from the mountain and floating around and coming down and moving around. And they're too big to be insects because you can see them from a distance. And I remember I was talking to one of my indigenous teachers at one point, and I was asking him about those, you know, and he said, oh, those are the spirit lights. Those are the spirit shield lights. They're like guardian lights. So, you know, it's just ongoing. In terms of some of the other types of beings, the most common stories I've heard are stories about the little people. I have to officially knock on wood when I talk about the little people.
I hear the wood, yes.
Yeah, you're really not supposed to talk about the little people except at certain times of the year. We're getting into that time of the year. You're only supposed to talk about the little people during the winter. Otherwise, they're out and about. If you talk about them during the summer, what I've been told is they're out and about, and they will hear themselves being talked about, and they will become interested and come in your house because they want to hear what you have to say about them. My teachers have very specifically warned me not to wander around in the woods by myself here, and not just because of bears, which we do have, and the fact that I'm a klutz and tend to fall off of things, which is also true, but because there are little people about, little people will tend to do the similar kinds of things. If you think about the story of Rip Van Winkle, you know, which yeah. I do talk about in the book. The whole Rip Van Winkle story is a kind of a combination, the way Washington Irving did it. It's kind of a combination between certain European motifs, because European folk stories also have little people who come and, you know, secret people away. But it's sort of like a combination story between certain European motifs and certain things that he had heard from indigenous storytellers. So it's sort of a combination story of those things. And you get a lot of the same kinds of effects, you know, the time runs differently. And the little people are kind of tricksters. Now, around here, the little people aren't known, at least according to the lore I've heard. The little people around here are mostly fairly secretive because the valley's been built up a lot, you know. So there's not a lot of places for them to hang out. So they tend to be secretive, but they also tend not to appreciate people looking for them very much. They're not overly fond of people anymore. For obvious reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
you know. And then another being that I talk about connected to this area specifically. I mean, I talk about a few types of beings that are not only connected to the Hudson Valley, but to surrounding environs like up in the Adirondacks. Because, you know, geographically, even though we kind of demarcate these places, in fact, you know, it's kind of a continuum between these different environments. But the other being that I talk about at some length in the book is a being that was referred to as Misikwe, who is probably, at least among the Munsee people that lived right where I live, was one of the most important beings. And he was understood to be a guardian of the forest. And he had some characteristics that would not be dissimilar to a Bigfoot, although he varied in size, you know, so it depended. Like for the Wappingers, who are on the east side of the river and more south, moving more towards where New York City is now, they describe Misikwe as being kind of short and hairy, whereas up where I live, he was more of a the size of like a standing erect bear would be, so he was larger. But he was associated with the harvest festival, or what was called the great house ceremony, which occurred every fall. It was an ancestral ceremony and a harvest ceremony, kind of all wrapped together. If you can kind of think about like harvest festivals and Halloween, sort of all wrapped together. And it lasted for 12 days. And all of the clans from the area, from surrounding villages, would get together in this really large sinkulcon, or that's what they called the really large structure they would build for this. And they would use it as an opportunity to reflect about the year, to settle feuds, and to share, clan by clan, share their dreams and visions and prophecies of the future. And so it was a time for everybody to kind of gather together before winter. And then as part of this, they would call Misikwe and reestablish a relationship with him. And it was said that he would appear, and it wasn't an impersonator. I mean, there were impersonators, you know, people who would don his mask, which was a mask that was made out of the bark or the wood of a living tree, and then painted half black and half red. So there was a mask associated with him, but the mask was mostly used to decorate the Tinquicon. And so, you know, there have been some indigenous people here who have speculated that some of what people are seeing when they see Bigfoot, that it might be an expression of Misikwe trying to connect with people and warn them about our really crappy relationship with the forest, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, I talk about those things because they sort of represent a continuum of experience, because people through the years, as I talk about it in the various chapters, people through the years have continued to see some of these things that are reported pre-settler. Although described in, you know, I mean, they're described in similar ways, but the significance of them is different, you know. And I do that in order to indicate how incredibly ancient a lot of these accounts or experiences are. And then you have, you know, various European layers to this that add to the lore, that add to different types of experience. So
I like the way you deal with it, because, you know, there's a difference in our cultures, and saying that one is paranormal and the other is natural, there's a huge divide there, because for the paranormal, usually that is indicated as it's going to be spooky, scary, unfamiliar, frightening. Where if you consider right. it a natural element, it's just another aspect of our reality that we have yet to figure out, deal with, relate to, understand.
Right. Like I say in the book, it's not that there weren't sometimes unusual things that happened. You know, it's not that indigenous people never got scared.
Yeah.
You know, or never had you know, they have monster stories too. And I do talk about some of their monster stories. But even in the case of monsters, and there were times when people felt like they needed to defend themselves against monsters in one type or another. But even in the case of monsters, they're not seen as evil like we would see them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They're not seen as, you know, like the Puritans would have seen them or would see things like this as proof that Satan lived in the wilderness, which is what they believed anyway.
Dr. Wham, this is Wendy's Coffee House. Wendy's Coffee House, my guest, Dr. C.S. Matthews. You can follow her blog at ProfessorWham.com.
One of the things, I can't remember whether it's actually in the book or not, because I can't remember, it's been a while since I've written the book.
So
I can't remember whether I was told this before or after the manuscript of the book was actually published, but the people who lived right where I live, the Muncie, they referred to themselves by a very specific name, and that name is Iliwi. And what that word meant was, we who take counsel only from the heart of the forest. That's literally what it means. So for them, whatever warning or guidance that they would get about the world, they would find in the woods, you know, in the world. And so if they had these experiences, they were understood as messages. They were understood as interactions with other intelligences, other consciousnesses that live with us, live next to us. Whereas, you know, Europeans coming would see those manifestations as manifestations of the devil. So you can kind of see the difference there.
Yeah. A stark difference. And that still exists.
Yeah, so, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to just talk about that is because one of the discussions that we have, like in the Bigfoot group that I'm in, you know, that I'm the consultant for, and some of the other people that I talk to who've had these experiences around here, is one of the discussions we have is, you know, we call these things paranormal, but they also seem to be part of the landscape. So maybe there's an attempt at communication that's going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, I fully agree. I think there is a communication attempt, and we're learning. There are some people who have established very clear methods to communicate. And one of them I know, Brian Bland, I interviewed him a while back, and he's a way of ciphers, you know, just arranging different shapes in the wood and then conversing back and forth with the group he is connected to. He's also just recently written a book. I haven't read it, but it's fascinating because they have developed some way to connect, and it happens to be using tools of sticks to make designs and, like I said, ciphers, hieroglyphics. And that is a clear example of, yes, some of these beings are able to communicate. And if you take the time and have the interest and are willing to learn, then you can have these kind of connections.
Right. Well, and, you know, I would think that they would want to connect because what we're doing is damaging the world they live in, too.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, they have a vested interest in making contact.
Where you are, what you're talking about consulting, what do people ask? What's the most common question?
Oh, well, I'm a consultant for the Bigfoot researchers group here. And what I usually consult on, a lot of times when the woman who started the group, her name is Gail Beatty, a lot of times when Gail goes to a new research site, you know, she gets a call from somebody and she's going to do a little bit of field research. When she asks them some of the opening questions, sometimes they will talk about not only the Bigfoot or cryptid experience they had, but oftentimes other things will have happened too. Like they will have seen strange lights in the sky, or they will have had a UFO experience or something, you know, or they'll have had some poltergeist activity in the house. It's actually rather common. It's not just that they saw a Bigfoot in their backyard. You know,
right.
Those experiences seem to be couched in a continuum of experiences. And so if there's a lot of those kinds of experiences, Gail always has me come out and talk to the people, too, because she's terrified of UFOs. That's how she puts it. She's terrified of those stories, and she doesn't like ghost stories very much. She's a deeply committed Catholic, and those, they kind of freak her out a little bit. She can kind of deal with the Bigfoot stuff because she has had some experiences along those lines herself. So she kind of has the context for that, you know, mm-hmm. but the rest of it kind of freaks her out. So I basically just sort of, and I also act as sort of a clearinghouse for her so that if she runs across some things, she'll ask me about them. Have you ever heard of this kind of stuff? You know, have you ever heard of this kind of a report? What do you think of this? You know, there have been times when she has talked to me about someone who's contacted her so that she can kind of try to determine whether or not this person is giving her a real report or just being a crank.
Yeah.
She gets some of those
yeah.
too. So, and I have a lot of experience dealing with cranks. So, you know, I just help her sort of do that, you know, give her advice. Ask them this, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and because I, if you ask them the right questions, a lot of times you sort of flush them out.
Yes. Yeah.
So that it's stuff like that. You know, it's not like paid consulting work. It's just, you know, it's more like just conversation about weird stuff so that she can kind of figure out. She does more of the field research than I do. So she can kind of figure out like the next steps.
I remember trying to tell about my UFO activity, and it includes paranormal activity, but there's a significant factor that not everybody mentions. And, you know, because I mention it now, somebody else might say it, but there is something that the researchers know, and it has to do with barometric pressure shift. There will be,
right.
some people call it ozone. I didn't have that language. I just said, like, you're standing at the top of a mountain and the air is thin.
right.
Yeah. So, but there are some cues or keys or clues when that activity is present, and then it also, the paranormal stuff increases, the telepathic influence is there where you'll get conversation and sometimes requests to do something or not do something. And it's very clear. There's no doubting when that happens that there's something trying to connect with you, something, someone. And that wasn't, in my understanding, part of the UFO experience until recently when more people started talking about it and sharing their stories. And I'm glad they did, because apparently for a long time, these elements have been part of it. It just wasn't common knowledge.
Well, it wasn't reported. It was sometimes actually omitted by researchers. I mean, that there's an unfortunate long history of a certain, especially in the UFO community,
yeah,
of certain types of reports just simply being, or certain elements of certain types of reports just sort of being edited out
and dismissed.
Yeah. I can even name you some of the investigators who are responsible for this.
Yes.
But I'm not, you know,
quite a long list.
Uh-huh. Right. But part of it originally was, I think, because there was this sense among some investigators that you know, when they were thinking about, you know, some of the contactees, like in the 50s, and
yeah,
and they would make these grandiose claims about stuff, and it turned out that some of them were cranks and some of them were actually relatively serious in terms of, you know, what they were trying to convey. But I think that there was this sense, especially in the late 60s and early 70s, after the publication of the Betty and Barney Hill abductee case. So I think there was this sense, especially among those UFO investigators who were, you know, of the quote-unquote nuts and bolts school, that if you had stuff like that, that scientists wouldn't take it seriously.
That's right.
Because they would just see it as, you know, just more weird, a proof of some kind of psychological imbalance.
Yeah.
Well, scientists, you know, at least publicly, scientists aren't going to take you seriously, whether if you're a UFO investigator, whether you're recording these things or not. So, you know, it's sort of a moot point. But if you go back to investigators like Jacques Vallée or John Keel, you know, they've been including this kind of information in their data collection forever.
Which is great. You know, it's just part of the framework. And if you overlook that, you don't have anything to compare when later on these things become a lot more prevalent as they are now, and have a context for it and say, okay, this is more than just a hallucination. And not only that, it's being repeated multiple times across different on the planet, on different continents, in different societies, with different ethnicities, the whole nine yards. So this isn't what they would used to call a collective hallucination.
Yeah. I mean, part of what some of the work that I've been doing lately is, like on my website and stuff, I've been very carefully going through the last publication that Jacques Vallée has done with Paola Liapitsa, about the Trinity, what's called the San Antonito UFO quote unquote crash case, which is an account of a crashed UFO, which was reported in 1945, like almost 2 years exactly before Roswell or any of that stuff happened. And the story behind it, the account of the crash itself is actually not that interesting. What's interesting is the context of the story and who tells the story and where it comes from. And I mention it now because there's an important element of indigenous story here too. Part of the reason why the story didn't come out until much, much later, or was regarded as important until much, much later, was because the principals who witnessed the event were of Latino, indigenous background, and they were poor, and they were right in the fallout area, the major fallout area of the Trinity test. They were only 15 miles from the Trinity test.
Yeah.
And their area suffered a lot of the initial fallout. And nobody there was told that this was happening. So all of these things are kind of connected. But what's really fascinating is that the principal witnesses were at the time when they witnessed this were little boys, you know, like ages 7 and 9. And they saw this weird thing happen, and this craft crash, apparently. They didn't actually see it crash. They saw the results of it crashed, you know. And they were hiding behind rocks in an REO out of, you know, trying to watch what was going on. And they saw these beings come out of it, or not really out of the whatever it was that crashed, because they said it looked like an avocado, which is just fascinating. But that the beings were, they were insectozoid. They looked like praying mantises, and they were uttering these cries of distress. And what was interesting about the little boys is that, according to both of them, these cries of distress so affected them that they, when they were recounting it years later, decades later, it still really upset them, these cries of distress. Even though nobody seemed to be injured, really, that they could see, and they felt like there were images or ideas being put into their minds just by watching what was going on. And what's fascinating about the story is that nobody else reports the beings. There was an army detachment that was sent to clean up the mess. They know that. some very strange things have happened to the site since. Obvious attempts to initially at least cover some stuff up, and then you know, there's been just further development on the land since then. But then when you find out the history of the land was an Apache ceremonial site. It's very, very close to a number of important pueblos, and very close to an area that was involved in the Pueblo Revolt back in the 1600s. I mean, it's like the whole, when you actually hear the context of it, like from a spiritual perspective, you're just like, something happened here. And it was obviously connected to the Trinity test, because it occurred like exactly a week, or no, maybe exactly 10 days after Nagasaki was bombed. And then, you know, so there were three bombs that were used. And it occurred almost exactly to the day that a very, one of the most important geopolitical events in Northern America occurred, the Great Pueblo Revolt of 1680, in which all of the Pueblo people in the South, in what is now New Mexico and Arizona, all of them rose up at one time in a three-day period and drove every single Spaniard off the continent for 12 years. Wow. And a lot of people don't even know that story.
No, huh?
You know, and so, it, you know, there's a lot of weird coincidences and synchronicities with this account. And so, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot. I've written like three blog posts about it because of how significant I think this story might actually be. But what's important about what Ballet says, and this is something that has implications for what you were talking about, all these different kinds of cases happening around the world, is he says, you know, in the nuts and bolts school of thinking, they concentrate on you know, the fact that a craft crashed and that there were beings, and you know these had to be extraterrestrial. They had to, you know, they had said, what if the craft was supposed to crash? What if the crash was the message? What if this is actually an attempt to communicate something symbolically? When you think about that, it's like, and he pulls up a bunch of other cases from around the world where similar kinds of things, not exactly the same, but there are some interesting similarities in terms of dynamics that occur. He talks about an important case in Valenciennes, France, which is a very well attested case that was actually investigated by the French military. No one doubts that something happened there. It left physical traces. The farmer, he was a lavender farmer. He had some kind of interaction with somebody there. Mm-hmm. But he also had very incredibly spiritual experiences with what was happening. And one of the interesting things that comes up in all these stories is this idea of secrecy. And part of secrecy, you know, just kind of like the indigenous people here where I live had to become very secretive in how they lived in order to maintain certain of their relationships with each other and with history and with the land and with the beings here. There's this idea that you maintain secrets not only for the sake of privacy, but you maintain secrets because some things are just for you alone. Yeah. You know, if you have a spiritual experience, that's your vision. That's your relationship with whatever that is. And you're really, you know, in most spiritual systems, you're really not supposed to talk about it that much. You know what I mean? You're supposed to live it. You live it. You don't Right. talk about it. So, I mean, for people who are listening to this and haven't read the latest book by Jacques Ballet, which is called Trinity, The Best Kept Secret, I'd recommend it because it brings those questions up within the context of a UFO investigation.
C.S. Matthews, Dr. C.S. Matthews, also known as Dr. Wham. The website, ProfessorWham.com. She also has a blog. Some of the recent titles, Prisoners of Our Own Device, Contact with Colliding Worlds, multiple parts on that one, and A Tale of Two Stalkers. Again, this is a two-part interview. The story in the second part talks about her encounter with a spider that's extraordinary. Links are in the description for the show, and my blog is Talking to Nightlights on WordPress. I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for listening.